supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we continue our discussion of the ongoing efforts to censor voices critical of U.S. empire, from journalists to veterans and whistleblowers. We're joined by Abby Martin of the Empire Files about recent attacks on her work at Telesur. Mike Preisner, noted activist and veteran against the current wars, joins to discuss his latest work on the Eyes Left podcast that encourages resistance within the military. We'll close the program with independent journalist Kevin Gostola from Shadowproof.com about NSA whistleblower Reality Winner's case and recent sentencing. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On the program today, we are welcoming back, no stranger to the Project Censored audience. We are speaking first today with journalist Abby Martin of the Empire Files. Also does podcast at Media Roots, mediaroots.org. Of course, listeners to the program also may remember Abby Martin from Breaking the Set on RT. And in fact, has the distinction of being accused by the U.S. government of fomenting radical discontent on that program. So, Abby, that certainly wins you the award of getting invited back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Also, like to remind listeners, Abby Martin wrote the foreword to our new book this year, so that'll be out October 2nd. Fantastic kickoff to the book that Andy Roth and I finished this summer. It's Censored 2019. Fighting the Fake News Invasion. So, Abby Martin, why don't we start there with some of the problems of this fake news invasion? Kind of this whole Trojan horse of fighting fake news has led to a spate of censorship from right to left in online platforms and elsewhere. Do you want to comment on that?
Absolutely. I mean, you talked about the DNI report very briefly. This is a report that was supposed to be the end-all, be-all, proving this Russiagate narrative. How did Trump collude with the Russian government? Unfortunately, what it was just a crude analysis of RT programming, which included my show, which had ended 2 years prior to this report even got published. And like you said, I mean, my show was accused of fomenting radical discontent. And what did that radical discontent entail? No, it was not talking about Russia or Putin or even Trump. Again, this was 2 years before the election even happened. It was talking about inequality. It was talking about police brutality, giving room to third-party candidates. So that's what the radical discontent is, Mickey. And you see this kind of wave. After the 2016 election, it became very clear that, quote-unquote, fake news and, quote, Russian disinfo were virtually one and the same to this neo-blob punditry class that encompasses what the real news is, according to them, the Washington Post, the New York Times, that set that narrative for the Beltway. So ever since then, you've just seen it completely take off, where over the last year, actually at the end of last year, you saw a Senate committee actually plead to Google, Facebook, and YouTube to censor, to preemptively ban and backpage and deplatform content that, quote, sowed discord. So you see these phrases over and over again, sowing discord, fomenting radical discontent, where it really is all-encompassing now, Mickey, where everyone from Jill Stein on CNN is being told she's repeating Kremlin talking points for simply talking about our foreign policy. So I think that's the real crux of it here, because over the last year, with Google using their algorithm, no different than what they're doing in China, using an algorithm to backpage left media, Project Censored, Counterpunch, Truthdig, all of these people have seen drastic drops in their web traffic because of these algorithms. Then you go to Facebook. You have Mark Zuckerberg. For some reason, we trust him as the purveyor of our reality, right? These tech giants who we trust to curate our perception of what's going on in the world, because I guess we're not smart enough to do so ourselves. Then you have Facebook complying with the government, working with a think tank stacked with defense contractors, military agencies, oil corporations. You can't make this up. CIA officials. So it becomes a little bit murky, the free speech censorship issue, when you have a coordinated purge of someone like Alex Jones But then you see left media as really kind of also being attacked totally under the radar. And unlike Alex Jones, we don't have millions of people that will buy an app. We don't have people that will just transition over to another platform. We're screwed. We're totally screwed. And you see, this is the ultimate goal from the establishment, is to conflate the alt-left and the alt-right and all of these ridiculous narratives, really just pushing a bipartisan consensus of endless war, militarism, and essentially corporate tyranny. And anyone who doesn't fall in line to this consensus is going to be purged. And it's just very apparent. And then you turn to Tel Assur, and we can talk about what's happening next with that. But it's just unbelievable, Mickey, that here we are, and people are actually cheering this on.
I definitely want to tag on to that, because you just said the mouthful. People are cheering on this censorship while simultaneously saying that this doesn't violate the First Amendment because these are private corporations. Well, when you have six corporations that control 90% of that media, right, we're well beyond looking at the First Amendment from that perspective. But also, you know, Andy Lee Roth and I wrote a piece on the ProjectCensor.org site called Protecting Free Speech in Fearful Times. We have a new piece up by Professor Andrew Austin, who was on the show last week, Defending the Digital Commons, a Left Libertarian Critique of Speech and Censorship in the Virtual Public Square, that addresses this serious problem. And you can possibly imagine that even though we're not coming out in defense of the content of an Alex Jones per se, we're calling attention, canary in coal mine fashion, that this is exactly what the purpose of the weaponization of fake news as a term was. This is exactly what the agenda has been, is to marginalize voices of dissent. You have been on the front lines of this. And tell our listeners now what has been going on with the Empire Files vis-a-vis Tel Assur.
You guys covered it in Project Censored a couple of years ago, these search algorithms that really destroy the democratization and this kind of egalitarian nature of what the internet was created to be like, and are buying into these social media companies, you know, and putting our content out there. And before I get really quickly into Tel Assur, I mean, you saw Senator Chris Murphy basically saying InfoWars is the tip of a giant iceberg of hate and lies that tears our nation apart. The companies must do more to take down more than one website. The survival of our democracy depends on it. So you have to ask yourself, how far is this going to go? And again, sowing discord, what does that really mean according to whoever is making these decisions in D.C., Mickey? So when it comes to Tel Assur, Tel Assur was created as a joint project between Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro when they were trying to combat this corporate media hegemony, this narrative of regime change against both of their countries, frankly, from the corporate media that we all know too well controls 90% of everything that we see, hear, and read. So they started Tel Assur, and that's always been a thorn in the side of the empire, because we know that there are very few outlets. You know, there's a reason why state media is one of the only places that you can tell the truth about the corporate control. You can tell the truth about U.S. imperialism. So Tel Assur has always been a target from the U.S. and the U.S.-backed opposition on the ground in Venezuela that has been funded with over $50 million in the last 10 years alone. You saw back in 2015, a coup attempt on the ground in Venezuela involved bombing the headquarters in Caracas. You saw us getting ambushed by lynch mobs. We had to flee for our lives. We were confronted saying, are you Tel Assur journalists? If we said yes, we probably would have gotten killed in the streets. After we left Caracas doing on-the-ground reporting, our colleague from Tel Assur was actually ambushed with bombs, gunshots. She was actually shot in the back. Luckily, she had a bulletproof vest on. So this has been a target. During the Bush administration, however, when the coup happened that kidnapped Hugo Chavez at the barrel of a gun back in 2002, amazingly, sanctions were never employed by the Bush administration. I was surprised to learn that. It wasn't until 2015, from this bizarre notion just out of the total blue, that Venezuela was deemed a national security threat, a unique national security threat. I don't know if that's because it has the largest oil reserves in the world or because of the pink tide suddenly awakened the beast of the empire saying, hold on, we need to reinstate hegemony in this region. But that's when sanctions were first employed under Obama. And so it started to kind of seize Tel Assur's ability to function then. But when the Trump administration got in, that's when you saw these sanctions rise to an insane height. They kept increasing over and over again, but it really, really came to a head right after the Democratic re-election of Maduro and this landslide victory at the end of May, where 5 million people came out in droves. We're talking about in a country of 20 million people. I mean, that's a lot for a bloc to come vote for what we call this dictator who's gunning down people in the streets. It's all one big lie, of course, once you're on the ground, which we've showed over and over again in the Empire Files. But Trump decided to heavily sanction Venezuela at that time to punish the Venezuelan people for, quote-unquote, choosing the wrong leader. choosing a leader that the empire didn't agree with. So what those sanctions did is that they are actually one of the most severe rounds of sanctions in the world, especially in this region, since Nicaragua back in the 1980s, when we were waging a full-blown bloody war against the Nicaraguan people. So just keep that in mind. And, of course, what the sanctions are intended to do, no, they're not against corrupt government officials, like everyone says. They are intended to seize the economy, just like Allende with Kissinger saying, we're going to make Chile's economy scream to install Pinochet. That's exactly what they're doing in Venezuela. The sanctions are affecting the most poor, vulnerable people in that country, preventing food and medicine, and seizing Telesur's ability to function. So contract journalists for the last 6 months all over the world have not been able to receive funds. We had Tariq Ali's show just shut down. And I think this is just one giant happy happenstance for the U.S. empire. Collateral damage as the latest round of sanctions. So we can't actually completely verify and identify that we are a target from the U.S., but I think that this is just a really happy coincidence for them that Telesur has essentially seized its ability to report and to fund a show like The Empire Files, which is really one of the only in-depth investigative series that is exposing the crimes and atrocities of the U.S. empire on a daily basis, Mickey.
So, Abby, speaking of coincidence, do you think it's a coincidence that almost immediately after Mark Zuckerberg goes to Congress and faces their somewhat untechnical questions, that Facebook then decides to start censoring Alex Jones and other platforms that would then appease Congress? Do you think that this is in some sense an olive branch so that Facebook and other social media platforms can dodge regulation for another couple of years?
Yeah, I think it's really amazing. Absolutely, man. I mean, I talked about that Senate committee where they basically were saying preemptively ban and censor these pages. We already know about Mark Zuckerberg working with the Israeli government to basically accompany 95% of Israeli government requests to shut down Palestinian Facebook pages that deem selling Discord or whatever the hell this phrase that I continue to hear means. We know that Palestinians actually use Facebook for the majority of their news intake. So already on that front, Facebook is already curating this kind of reality for Palestinians and shutting down their ability to dissent. What I find really strange about this, days after this Maduro assassination attempt, which of course was traced back to Bogota and Miami, amazing enough, where you have right-wing pundits actually saying they were sitting in on a meeting in Miami privy to the assassination attempt. So I don't believe Trump and Bolton saying we have nothing to do with it. Come on. They're talking constantly about invading Venezuela. But right after this assassination attempt, we're talking about literally days, you had Facebook arbitrarily shutting down Telesur English and Venezuela Analysis. These are two pages that literally are the only counters to U.S. regime change narratives about Venezuela. I mean, we are ad nauseum 24/7, a constant push, a bipartisan consensus for regime change in Venezuela and for the overthrow of Maduro. So these two pages are actually very essential for people to understand what is going on, an alternative to this constant hysteria that we hear. So the fact that both of those pages were shut down at such a crucial moment, I do not think is a coincidence. I think that this is very intentional. We know that Facebook is already working and completely acquiescing to the U.S. government. It's just astounding.
We're speaking with Abby Martin, journalist from The Empire Files. Abby Martin also does podcasting with Robbie Martin at mediaroots.org. Abby, also speaking of Facebook, it isn't just Facebook, of course. We've seen, you know, Google talking about spiking searches and actually even removing things from their platform. Of course, we are aware that this has happened in other countries, but people need to realize that this is happening in the United States. And as people cheer on the censoring of a particular character, high-profile character that they have distaste for, we may, of course, really be losing whatever tenuous grasp we have on concepts of free speech and expression. And, of course, you started to highlight, you know, some of the powers that be and who is being placated here. From the national security state to the military-industrial complex, one of the groups, of course, that's working with Facebook is the Atlantic Council, right?
Atlantic Council, you have Henry Kissinger, you have former CIA chief Michael Hayden, you have former acting CIA head Mike Morrell. This is the guy who on PBS said we should kill Russians and Iranians in Syria to teach Russia a lesson. This is sadistic. You have former Bush DHS chief Michael Chertoff, that infamous dude who created the color-coded terror alert threat, as well as, get this, the UAE government. The UAE government, I mean, on top of all the corporations that I mentioned. So what I find very interesting, Mickey and Chase, is the fact that we never hear about Qatari. We never hear about Saudi accounts. We never hear about Israeli fake trolls and disinformation online. There's a Wahhabi troll farm being implemented to correct the record about Saudi Arabia. There are so many trolls, pro-Israel trolls. We know that they're awarded a hot air balloon ride around Tel Aviv for whoever can correct the most Wikipedia entries on behalf of Israel.
And by correct, you mean conform with official narratives. So, Abby Martin, tell us then what has happened recently with your program, Empire Files, because of what's happened with Telesur, and is there a way you can tell people how to learn more or help support the work you're doing?
You really cannot look at this in isolation without understanding that this is part and parcel with a larger regime change operation, not just in Venezuela, but of course all throughout Latin America. The Trump administration clearly wants to reinstate hegemony, militarism around that region. And that's why we're seeing the support for these reactionary resurgences everywhere from Brazil to Argentina. Lenin Moreno has already totally folded under U.S. pressure, using Julian Assange as a pawn. I also wanted to say that this is coming off of Venezuela Analysis and Telesur being taken down and arbitrarily reinstated on Facebook. But already, Telesur and the Empire Files content has been hit with age restrictions, sensitive content bans. You can't even go on Twitter without having to sign in to actually see Telesur's content. You can't go to our on-the-ground reporting in Venezuela without actually having to sign in and prove your age. You can't watch our documentary about socialism without proving that you're 18 years old. So all of this has already been going on, as well as the demonetization, of course, that we already know. The Empire Files, what we're doing right now is crowdfunding. And unfortunately, the state of media is just so abysmal, which is why Project Censored exists, which is why we're trying to do what we do. And unfortunately, we're at the point where we need to crowdfund our efforts because of the abysmal state of our media today and the lack of support for real investigative journalism, which is just incredibly hard to come by. So what we're asking for is people to donate on Patreon to become monthly subscribers, or our GoFundMe, and you can look up Keep Empire Files going on GoFundMe, or Patreon /Empire Files. And what we're looking to do next is, we already bought a bunch of footage from Gazan journalists who are risking their life every day going to that fence, that prison fence in the Gaza border, risking their life as Israeli soldiers continue to execute unarmed Palestinian protesters, I think over 170 now. So we have people who interviewed the slain nurse, Razan al-Najjar's family. We have people there interviewing medics, journalists, amputee families who were shot, some were killed. Really just incredible footage there that we want to get out. But this costs money, unfortunately, as we know. I mean, this stuff is not cheap. So there's a lot of stuff on the shelf. There's me on the ground in Colombia with the FARC, walking around these peace zones after the Civil War. And, of course, that's a very contested area after Manuel Santos has left. And now we have Uribe's party back in power that want to destroy the peace deal. So a lot going on. And, of course, if we have enough funding to continue after that footage, then we want to do documentaries on Trump's military machine, the war machine under Trump, and also the environmental destruction and activists who continue to get targeted by corporations and governments around the world as we're on the precipice of this cataclysmic climate crisis. So with the Empire Files, we try to look at every issue in the world through that lens of U.S. empire. You cannot look at any issue in the international spectrum without understanding how the colonized and colonizers have shaped that region of the world. And you really can't look at any issue introspectively on the domestic front without understanding how enormous the U.S. military has shaped and just squandered all the resources and really neutered our ability to really thrive as a people and provide for the poor and most vulnerable people of our society. So it's a really crucial show to continue, and I'm so thankful for the outpouring of support. I'm really thankful for you guys giving me a platform here to talk about what's going on.
So, Abby, a lot of independent journalists are turning to GoFundMe and Patreon as a last resort, especially when censored by certain platforms. Do you see this not as a last resort, but as the future revenue model for journalism? How do you think about how we can save or fix the revenue models involved with online journalism?
That's the big question, right? That's the age-old question. How do we actually create a media for the people, by the people? And we all know the state of late-stage capitalism that we're in. I mean, that's why Trump is president, and that's why corporations literally dictate reality for us on their behalf. So, you know, with a corporate media that's subsidized by oil companies and defense contractors, it really seems hopeless when there just is no funds. And it is really sad, because we're talking about a country where half of the population is living without enough savings for an emergency. 70% of Americans don't have $1,000 in their bank account. So it's really tough to go out there and say, hey, we got to ask for funding to keep this work alive. I wish that I had an answer. I think right now, with this really screwed screwed up system that we're living in, we have to go to start funding the journalists that we want to see and supporting them. And we have to start generating mirrors of our work. Don't rely on these tech companies to harness all of your data. Don't relinquish control where they could just be shut down willy-nilly one day. And it's happening from WordPress. You see calls to shut down Medium for people who are countering the regime change narratives there. It's getting very dangerous and scary, but we need to be smarter. And we need to be one step ahead of these companies. So it's banding together with organizations like Project Censored and supporting these grassroots initiatives that already exist that can expand and start supporting the networks of journalists who are speaking truth to power around the country and really building those voices up so we can start building our own platforms and not relying on these kind of criminal institutions.
Abby Martin, The Empire Files. You can learn more at theempirefiles.tv. You can also hear Abby at mediaroots.org and the podcast there. Also, you can catch Abby Martin this October at College of Marin, north of San Francisco. October 26 and 27 is the Media Freedom Summit 2.0, Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice, speaking of solutions to these challenges we face. Abby will be there doing a keynote roundtable with several other amazing women journalists, so you can learn more about that at projectcensored.org. Abby Martin, thank you so much for the important work that you do, and thank you so much for taking time out to come back on the Project Censored show today.
Buy the Project Censored book, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. You guys rock. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much, Abby. Up next on the Project Censored show, we'll be joined by Mike Preisner, who is a producer of The Empire Files, but we'll be talking to him about a new podcast and project he's working on called Eyes Left, talking about how experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan led he and a partner of his to become socialists, and why U.S. troops should resist U.S. foreign policy, particularly talking about encouraging resistance from inside the war machine. Please stay with us.
Now I'm just a farmer from Arkansas. There's a lot of things I don't understand. Like why we send farmers to kill farmers in Afghanistan. Now I did what I was told for my love of this land. And I come home a shattered man with blood on my hand. And now I can't have a relationship. I can't hold down a job. Oh, when some may say I'm broken, well, I call a soldier's heart.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. Right now on the Project Censored Show, we're going to turn our attention to a new podcast called Eyes Left. You can hear the first podcast over at mediaroots.org. And of course, we just interviewed Abby Martin. Our guest right now is Mike Preisner. He is a producer for The Empire Files, and he also is one of the co-founders and co-hosts of a new podcast. Mike Preisner is a veteran, went into the so-called War on Terror into Iraq, and that process really radicalized him. And as a veteran, he has been opposed to the war. And this program, Eyes Left with Spencer Rapone, they discuss a vision and goal of this show, and that's what we're going to talk to Mike about today. They talk about how their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan led them to become socialists and why U.S. troops should resist U.S. foreign policy. So, Mike Preisner, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, thanks for having me, y'all.
So, Mike, talk to us about that process of radicalization, of getting into the military. For folks that are familiar with Iraq Vets Against the War and Afghan Vets Against the War and a lot of other veteran groups against these imperial wars, your name comes up over and over again. So certainly in that audience, you're no stranger. But tell the folks here in our audience a little bit about how that happened and how you then got to this show.
You know, people join the military for a variety of different reasons. be it for job training, for housing or healthcare, or it's because they've kind of adopted ideals that are pressed into our heads from birth in this country. But regardless of the reason that you join, when you find yourself in uniform, being deployed to another country, whatever this government is telling you it's about really falls apart, and you really get to see exactly what the wars are really for and what your role really is in the U.S. military. And so I was just like one of many hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. service members who really clearly saw the nature of the Iraq War as being about profits and expansion and nothing to do with human rights or self-defense. So I was one of many that became active in the anti-war movement, especially during the height of the Iraq War. But that's really what's behind the idea of this show. I woke up when I was in uniform. Spencer Rapone also woke up while he was in uniform, but we're by no means anomalies. And we know that right now, especially under the arch-reactionary, racist Trump administration, that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of active duty service members who are at least questioning their role in the U.S. military. And if not just questioning their role now in the world, but openly opposed to the action that the Trump administration is taking, whether it's sending the National Guard to aid Border Patrol to rip apart families at the border, or if it's about sending them to Syria to die and lose limbs for no reason in Syria. And so we want to be able to reach those people in the military to let them know that they're not alone, to let them know what they're really part of, help elevate their consciousness, help them understand really what their job is as a pawn on the imperial chessboard, and of course to tell them that they can say no, and that there is a variety of options and alternatives that they have that the military doesn't want them to know that they have, to get out of the military, to refuse deployment, or, of course, to use their position in the military to inspire some resistance or to help disrupt the Trump war machine.
Mike Prisoner, who better to come back and talk to the general population than veterans about what war really is about? And that, of course, is what the corporate media doesn't want to cover, right? We'll show the video game imagery of how the bombs take off and they're worshipped by our alleged corporate journalists, but they don't show what happens when the bombs hit the ground. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is why it's very important, I think, that you are doing this podcast. Can you tell our listeners where they can find more about it and how they can find out more about what you're up to?
You can go to social media on Twitter or Instagram, and it's at Eyes Left Pod. You can find us the show on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/Eyes Left. We can also search for Eyes Left on any major streaming platform, Google Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, all of those that people go to. We're on all of them. If you're in the military also, I mean, especially, or if you know anyone in the military, we especially want you to share it with them. And if you're in the military, please check us out and let us know that we want to be a resource for you. You know, if you're in the military now, you have every right to be questioning what you're a part of, whether or not you're stateside or whether or not you're facing being deployed. You're part of this military machine that's now under Trump's control. And so you have every right to not want to be a part of it. And there's a variety of options available to you that we can tell you about and we can help you through. And most importantly, one of the main reasons for launching this project, of course, is because we know that the military is a reflection of the general population. And so as young people, as the general population becomes more radical, becomes interested in anti-capitalism and in socialism and against war, now we know that that's reflected in the military as well. And we want to be there to help that sector of the military population. But most importantly, there is a real war danger under Trump. We know that the same exact people that sent us to war in Iraq, people like John Bolton, people that should be in a prison cell, they are now in power again. And they very much want to go to war with Korea. They very much want to go to war with Iran. And they very much want to escalate wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, and beyond. And you absolutely should not be a part of that. And you have every right to not be a part of that. And so in addition to just listening to the show, there's the Eyes Left podcast. We have make ourselves available. We have an email address. You can email us at eyesleftpod@gmail.com. Message us on Twitter. We want to be here for you to let you know the various options you have to refuse to have your life thrown away for some rich politician and to help destroy the lives of people we have no reason to fight.
Mike Prisoner, I want to thank you so much for all the work that you do against the empire and this war machine, and especially reaching out to help so many other people and other veterans that may be wondering how they can escape the situations that they're in and then what they can do about it if they're fortunate enough to get out. And also, your podcast, Eyes Left, is on the front page of MediaRoots.org. And of course, Mike Prisoner is the producer for the Empire Files. Mike, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on the Project Censored show to try to help uncensor veterans' voices against the war.
Thanks so much. Really love the work you guys do and really happy to be on.
Up next on the Project Censored show, we'll be joined by journalist Kevin Gostola. Some of our listeners may remember that Gostola was one of the only journalists that covered the entire Chelsea Manning trial. Well, Gostola was one of the few that covered the entire trial for NSA whistleblower Reality Winner, who just received the longest sentence ever for unauthorized disclosure. Up next on the program, Kevin Gostola. Stay with us.
Now you masters of war, you that build all of the guns, you that build the dead planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind the desk, just want you to know that I see through your mask.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. To conclude today's program, we are joined by Kevin Gostola. Kevin is returning to the program. He's been on before. Kevin is the managing editor of Shadowproof Press online at shadowproof.com. He also produces and co-hosts the weekly podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin Gostola was one of the only journalists that sat through the entire Chelsea Manning trial. And more recently, Gostola found himself in a similar situation as being one of the few journalists covering basically end to end the NSA whistleblower case involving Reality Winner. And Kevin Gostola has recently published a few pieces about this, about how Reality Winner has received the longest sentence ever for unauthorized disclosure. And that's what we'll be talking about and many related issues the rest of the program today. So, Kevin Gostola, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kevin, remind our listeners about the kind of journalism that you do, because this really puts you in a uniquely qualified position to be talking about the Reality Winner case. You know, this goes all the way back to the Chelsea Manning case.
Yeah, I spent at least 5 to 7 years now looking at whistleblower cases, examining them closely, and I suppose you could say making a name for myself by covering this. I've done a range of journalism on civil liberties issues and things related to the war on terrorism, but more than anything, I've focused on these individual cases that have been going on in real time. If you go all the way back to 2010, 2011, and really beginning with Chelsea Manning's court-martial, and then there was the John Kiriakou case, a former CIA officer who said that the Bush administration was waterboarding people and then became a target of the Bush Justice Department. And then the Obama Justice Department really came down on him and publishing letters from prison showing what it was like for a whistleblower to be incarcerated in a sentence for a leak, covering the Jeffrey Sterling case and looking at his treatment in federal prison. And having his back when he was being denied medical treatment in Colorado. I'm looking at these cases, and then now with the Reality Winner case, when that broke, paying that close attention. And it wasn't until the hearing in February that I made it out to Augusta, Georgia, but I was always following it closely at every stage with the filings that were being put up by defense attorneys and the government, looking at all the process, because I find it really important to cover these prosecutions under the Espionage Act, especially the way the law is, how antiquated and outdated it is and pernicious it is applied in very damaging ways. It doesn't just impact individuals who are former government employees. It's being used in ways that are detrimental to the media. And so I think that it's important to cover. I mean, it's used to put media sources in jail. That's really, when we get into the Reality Winner case in more detail, we're talking about an issue of sources being jailed. And so this is the kind of journalism that I've been doing, and I'll just say, to wrap this part, this answer up, that I feel like what was just accomplished in the last month here is truly an independent media success story, and I know that that's something that Project Censored likes to tell.
And we were able to raise $3,000 from people who are regular readers of us and have a membership with Shadowproof and follow us and contributed and really wanted me to be out there in Augusta covering this case because they trust me to bring the story to them.
So, Kevin, before we get into the specifics of the Reality Winner trial, I'm wanting to get a little bit more background for our listeners about the Espionage Act, which, as you know, was put into place during World War I and is also the reason that people like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden are fearful of coming back to the States to face trial because they don't want to be tried under the Espionage Act. So can you give us just a little bit more background on the Espionage Act and how it still applies today?
Very basically, the law was instituted in ways that were supposed to challenge people who were protesting World War I, and it was to challenge people who were protesting against military recruitment. It was to control enlisted officers who were possibly defiant of their chain of command. And it was to prosecute people who were deemed to be engaged in seditious acts against the government during this period of time. It expanded as something that could be used during the Red Scare to go after socialists, communists, anarchists. And it wasn't until Samuel Morrison in the 80s, the publication was Jane's Defense Weekly, where it involved the publication of some blueprints that actually escalated to a thing where they were going after journalists or where they were going after someone for releasing the information that had been classified and punishing them with the Espionage Act. It wasn't until Ronald Reagan that we see the Justice Department really recognizing that this might be a tool in order to control federal government employees. It really wasn't a thing during the 1990s that you saw these kinds of cases. They pick up in regularity when President Barack Obama is in office and you have more prosecutions under the Espionage Act than all previous presidents combined. And I know that Daniel Ellsberg was someone they pursued for a leak, but I don't believe it was under the Espionage Act in this way, though he was accused of espionage. These cases, the model that we see pursued by the government that the Justice Department used to go after Reality Winner really starts in the 1980s and then becomes perfected in the 2000s and then really in the 2010s with several cases, including Edward Snowden, who continues to be in Moscow, because if he comes back here, he will face this sort of prosecution. And again, we would imagine that it's possible if Julian Assange wasn't indicted, they might find some way to throw an Espionage Act charge against him.
Kevin Gostola, thank you for the quick history. That's, of course, a big part of how you got on the radar for us at Project Censored, is that you were someone consistently writing about whistleblowing, whistleblowers. Project Censored is a sponsor of the Whistleblower Summit every summer in Washington, D.C. We've done work with the National Whistleblower Center at whistleblower.org, Government Accountability Project. There are some organizations that really do work to help support whistleblowers. But again, highlighting your work, it's not always the case that whistleblowers get a hearing or get a fair hearing in the press. And that's your job as a journalist has been for many years now with this interest you have in whistleblowers. And you said, and this again bears repeating, it wasn't until the Obama administration that we saw a massive escalation in this assault on whistleblowers. And as you rightly noted, Obama persecuted and prosecuted more whistleblowers than all of the administrations prior combined. And now, under the presidency of Donald Trump, what we're seeing is, in the Reality Winner case, in the Reality Winner sentencing, the longest sentence ever for unauthorized disclosure. So we seem to be going in a very dangerous direction, certainly one that seems to be eroding our rights to information, and the assault on whistleblowers continues. So, Kevin Gostola, could you give our listeners a little background on the NSA whistleblower case here regarding Reality Winner?
What happened was a contractor for a company called Pluribus International, and they were located at Fort Gordon in Georgia, and she smuggled out a copy of a NSA report that was put together by an analyst looking at a hacking attempt that allegedly targeted U.S. voter registration systems. It was suspected that perhaps maybe these hackers could originate in Russia, although I don't believe that they were able to definitively confirm that that's where it was coming from. But the most important thing to the story is that she read this, and because of what was going on in the media around the Trump administration, and because so many people in the press were publishing stories about Russia and Trump and alleged interference, and she thought that this amounted to something that should be in the public conversation. As a quick caveat, whether this is exactly what the report reveals or not, that's for journalists to figure out. The person here who was blowing the whistle believed that she was uncovering something of critical importance, so she took it out of the office and mailed it, snail mail, not electronic. And actually, that's very good that she didn't do an electronic, because she could have been given another charge of misusing a government computer. So she is actually a rare case where she only faced one charge of violating the Espionage Act, and there weren't any other charges against her. She mailed the report to The Intercept, and those journalists there at The Intercept, which we can get into a little bit more, ended up basically tipping off the government to her because of the way they went about having the document verified. I'll leave it general for now. We can come back to that issue. And she was arrested. The FBI raided her home in Augusta. She was not read her rights. She was never Mirandized. She was denied bail. She was put in a county jail, Lincolnton County Jail. And it's a place for people who are held short-term, usually individuals who are accused of drug crimes or state offenses. And she was there to put together whatever defense she could. It was incredibly difficult because of the way the prosecution handled her and did not allow her to be out of prison, which was extraordinary. And then eventually the defense realized that they didn't have the ability to put together a defense because of the way in which the prosecutors are allowed to have so much latitude. They can do just about anything in their prosecution to find you guilty. It's also prosecuted as a strict liability offense. And for people who don't know what I mean by that basically amounts to you signed a document that was a non-disclosure agreement. You said that you knew that information was classified and that you needed to protect, and then you disclosed the information. So you knew that information was not information to be released. Therefore, you're guilty of violating the Espionage Act, and so we can jail you for up to 10 years. So she took a deal, a plea. She changed her plea on June 26th, and she accepted a deal for 5 years and 3 months, having already served about a year in prison, over a year in prison. And then on August 23rd, she was sentenced officially. The judge accepted this deal.
So, Kevin, you recently wrote a fantastic article at shadowproof.com where you interviewed the defense attorney for Reality Winner. His name is Titus Nichols. And he and you spoke a lot about how it's difficult to defend somebody that is being tried under the Espionage Act because you're in front of a judge and jury and you can't reveal the classified information that is essentially at the core of the trial. Can you tell us a little bit more about the challenges that the defense team faced against the government in this trial as they were trying to basically sway their opinion that she, Reality Winner, who has no previous criminal record and was held in jail previous to the trial, why this person didn't deserve the maximum penalty?
Yes, so Titus Nichols explained to me, and some of this I already knew from previous cases, but you can't really bring intent into it. You can't really bring in your knowledge into your defense. I mean, as far as what you're talking about with classified information, they say very clearly and directly that this leak caused exceptionally grave damage to national security. And we know that phrase. People who follow the media know that whenever there's a leak, that's what government officials go out and say to the press. And in some way or another, it usually gets spread and bandied about without a lot of question. But the fact is that they don't have to prove that in these cases. And that's the one key obstacle here, because if you want to use that as part of your defense to get them to put it on the record what that damage is, well, then they can just say, well, we've got these subject matter experts. They say that damage occurred. And so they put that in the record before, let's say, a jury or a judge. And you say, well, okay, so what is it? What is that damage? Well, we can't tell you what that damage is. It's classified. And if we told people what it was, then we would be causing further damage to national security because we're releasing more classified information that we think should be protected. So it's a game that they play, and it really prevents you from putting on a defense. And a struggle before you even get to trial is going through something called the Classified Information Procedures Act, and it's unlike any other process for any defendant because you have to bargain with prosecutors over different pieces of information and get them to declassify it just so that your client, if you're a defense attorney, just so your client can make a defense before a jury. And, of course, they want to win their case. They're going to, like, fight you on evidence that they don't want you to put out there. I mean, one thing that happened related to this is that they had 40 of 41 subpoenas denied because what they wanted to show was that this information that we're talking about that's in the report that was released may not have been protected in the way that a government's supposed to in order to claim authority over it. There's something to the Espionage Act where information has to be, quote, closely held, end quote. And so it's about whether those state governments, did they have security clearances when they were told about election hacking or targeting of voter registration systems? Is there information in this report that was being told to people and declassified so that they could address an issue that was prevalent? And many politicians were having discussions with local governments in 2017 about these issues. So what was she releasing that revealed anything that was sensitive? And they shut the defense down. The judge shut them down. The appeals court denied these subpoenas as well. And so it's not possible for them to put together a defense. And that's just the way that the Espionage Act is used and how it favors prosecutions, making it so that you take a deal for 5 years because you don't want to end up in prison for a decade.
We're speaking with journalist Kevin Gostola of Shadowproof.com. Kevin Gostola has a long history of writing about whistleblower cases going back to Chelsea Manning. Recently, of course, he was covering the Reality Winner case, and Reality Winner has received the longest sentence ever for unauthorized disclosure. We were just discussing that. But also earlier, Kevin Gostola, we kind of bookmarked momentarily the role journalism played here, or journalists played, and in particular, The Intercept. And of course, in the United States, we know there have been numerous cases, high-profile cases, actually, of journalists kind of being put in the hot seat for protecting sources. James Risen comes to mind, among others. But I wanted to return to that and have you talk a little bit about your view is on what role The Intercept played. And again, listeners know The Intercept is oft associated with journalists like Glenn Greenwald and others.
Yeah, and Jeremy Scahill. They have a lot of very well-respected people working for their organization. And I want to say, before I get into this, the most common thing I had when I told people I was going to Augusta to cover this case, and I was asking people to donate because I'm an independent journalist and that's the model we use to fund our work, I was usually met with the response of, well, The Intercept should be sending you down there. They should be paying for this, and they should be paying for that, because they're why this case is even going on. And I was somewhat conflicted, and I still am a bit conflicted over the extent of the responsibility they have for Reality Winner being put on trial. But I definitely think that, and it's agreed, and they've even, you know, taken some responsibility, but maybe not as much as they should. But it's clear that what they did led to the government more quickly identifying her. And what happened is there were journalists involved, like Matthew Cole and Richard Esposito, who were in the process of verifying the document. They did not get rid of metadata that was on the document. They were sharing it with an NSA contractor. They let them know that it was mailed from Augusta. And this is information that makes it very, very easy to out your source to the government. And it's conduct that, frankly, I believe Glenn Greenwald would oppose if this is something The Guardian had been doing with the documents from Edward Snowden, if they were contacting the NSA or any other government agency back in 2013. And so it's a sticky issue because I think that you have to hold The Intercept up to a standard, and it's uncomfortable to challenge them because they do great work. But at the same time, I think because you expect them to be a lot better and you don't expect them to be pathetic like the New York Times or the Washington Post and do things that reveal and expose your source to prosecution, that you don't want them to be so guarded about the way they talk about this. And I recently appeared on a Democracy Now! Segment with James Risen, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he's now involved in directing their Press Freedom Defense Fund. And he was asked by Amy Goodman if anything had changed in the way that they handle sources. And I think that's important because their brand, really, their identity, The Intercept, starts with Edward Snowden and having these documents that Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald went through and they published. They're a place where people can go to and they can pass on their documents. They're really good at that kind of journalism. But if there's a risk that people are going to be outed, it starts to dry up the flow of information, I'd imagine, something that they would have to do a lot better to protect people from. And I don't know that you can actually guarantee, but you have to do harm mitigation. You have to be able to do something. And so in this case, Jim was asked, and he basically said, well, we don't want to talk about how we handle anonymous sources. We don't want to talk about the way in which we get submissions. But I think that's kind of a cop-out because the issue here is verification. The issue comes at a different stage of the journalism process where you are going to the government now with information to figure out what you have and whether it's worth publishing and whether it is in fact authentic. And I believe that, like, at that point, it's important for us to know that what you're doing isn't going to reveal your source. And I think, you know, it's important for people who care about your work to know that you aren't being negligent. And also, in this case, two journalists, Matthew Cole and Richard Esposito, were involved in John Kiriakou being found out by the government. I mean, in fact, Matthew Cole is a journalist who made representations to John Kiriakou that he was writing a book on rendition and that he was going to be putting together this book. And so he needed John to confirm the name of an undercover agent. This is how John really got in trouble and ended up in jail. It turns out there was no book. He was working for some project that seemed to be helping Guantanamo prisoners, but he never represented what he was actually doing when he asked for the information. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff here that should be addressed, and I think they can address it now because Reality Winner, the case is pretty much over.
So, Kevin, you just pointed out that there is a risk for whistleblowers to go to these outlets and trust that their identities will remain private or anonymous. And then, obviously, there is the risk of being tried under the Espionage Act, so two very scary prospects for whistleblowers. Would you recommend that whistleblowers in the future turn to WikiLeaks for their leaks? What would you do if you were a whistleblower that was about to reveal some powerful NSA documents?
I'd get a lawyer. I'd get a lawyer before you go do anything with anybody and consider your options, because obviously proper channels are a bad route to go. Internally in the government, you can go to an inspector general, but they'll immediately know that you're on the radar, and depending on how damning your information is, whatever you are doing, they might decide to shut you down. This is what happened to Thomas Drake and other whistleblowers from the NSA who were revealing something related to private contractors. That's one issue. And then, you know, we have the issue of these organizations being outmatched. There are so many tools within the government to detect so-called insider threats. They're basically engaged in total surveillance and can engage in total surveillance of employees. And there are programs being pioneered every single day, especially since WikiLeaks spurred on these sort of programs because they frightened the government when all of those documents were published, when Chelsea Manning released all those documents. And after Edward Snowden, they've certainly done more to try and revolutionize the way they detect so-called insider threats. And so I think What's most important is for you as a whistleblower, or as a federal government employee, to decide what risk you want to take on. In many ways, you may have to come out. In many ways, Edward Snowden may have shown that, like, this is the way you can do it to protect yourself, but you're going to have to leave the United States. And I think the way things are under Donald Trump, it's worse than under President Obama. And it's so bad that basically what you're doing is you're driving whistleblowers away. I mean, you're creating a system where there are more leaks, where there's more chance that a huge swath of information, like tons of information, are just taken wholesale and people run with it. And that's good for me. That's good for you. That's good for all of us, because we want to see more information out there. And a lot of the times, you know, this stuff is definitely in the public interest. But then for government, I have to imagine that if they had to choose, they wouldn't want people to so easily get to run off with databases of classified information. But they're directly responsible for that. They're creating that by not having a system that allows whistleblowers to come forward, by making it harder for people to expose corruption and putting them under this great risk. They're responsible for the Edward Snowdens and the Chelsea Manning.
Kevin Gostola, we're about out of time for today's program, but could you share a little bit with our listeners some things that you're working on and what they can be looking for at shadowproof.com?
I mean, I'm going to continue to follow these whistleblower cases, these kinds of cases that are very important, especially when we need more public interest journalism and we need more dissent.
Kevin Gostola, could not agree with you more. I want to thank you for all the work that you've been doing over the last several years, your Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, and again, all the writing you do for shadowproof.com. So Kevin Gostola, thanks for telling us about this important case, and we look forward to following your work and having you back on the program in the near future.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program, with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers are Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Project Censored. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. And last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.